spike in interest in history since the pandemic began.
Why that is hard to say. I think that in times of crisis, it's typical for people to look to the past to learn how to deal with the current situation.
Then, film director Glenn Petrie offers us a glimpse into the immersive film experience he co-created for the HNOC called The French Quarter by Night.
There's multiple projectors, there's 10 channels of sound, just figuring out how to tell a story that way because, you know, people don't have eyes in the back of their heads.
Whether it's virtual or in person, we're looking at our past on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House physician says President Trump has been symptom-free for 24 hours. In a memo today, Dr. Sean Conley also said his COVID-19 patient had not had a fever in over 4 days. The public learned Trump was infected over 5 days ago. Conley says the 74-year-old president has not needed any supplemental oxygen since he was hospitalized at Walter Reed Medical Center last Friday. Trump returned to the White House late Monday. His illness and the confirmed infections of roughly a dozen of his closest White House staff are likely to figure prominently at tonight's debate between Vice President Mike Pence and Democratic Senator Kamala Harris. Both are also expected to spar over Trump's decision to halt coronavirus relief talks until after the election. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi questioned Trump's mental health after he halted negotiations on a pandemic relief bill. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports Pelosi continued her attacks today.
Speaking on ABC's The View, Pelosi called President Trump's abrupt decision to put talks on hold a missed opportunity to provide much-needed relief amid the pandemic.
It is really important for us to come to this agreement. When the president just popped off and made that announcement without even informing us that that was the case, he insulted the Constitution of the United States.
The Trump administration is proposing standalone legislation that would provide another round of direct payments for eligible Americans and additional relief for airlines and small businesses. Congressional Democrats say that doesn't go far enough in providing Americans what they need during the pandemic. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Two British Islamic State militants are facing federal criminal charges in the United States for their alleged role in the killings of American hostages. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports the men are accused of being members of a notorious ISIS cell nicknamed the Beatles.
The two defendants, Alexander Koti and El-Shafi El-Sheikh, face 8 counts in all, including conspiracy, hostage-taking resulting in death, and material support to a terrorist organization. According to the indictment, the men played a leading role in Islamic State's kidnapping, torturing, and killing of U.S. and European citizens. Among the group's victims were 4 Americans, journalists James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, and aid workers Peter Kasich and Kayla Mueller. Assistant Attorney General John Demers says while the U.S. government cannot bring the 4 Americans back, the Justice Department, quote, can and will seek justice for them, their families, and for all Americans. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The former Minneapolis police officer charged with the murder of George Floyd in May is out on bond. Derek Chauvin was videotaped pressing his knee on the African-American man's neck for nearly 9 minutes, despite Floyd's pleas that he could not breathe. You're listening to NPR News. More European countries are reinstating restrictions after witnessing a new surge in coronavirus cases. Today, Italy is requiring the public to wear masks outdoors, as NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports.
After substantially curbing the number of new coronavirus cases, Italy has seen a steady increase in infections over the last several weeks. Health Minister Roberto Speranza said the new measure is meant to prevent them from spiraling out of control after schools reopened in mid-September. The government has also extended the COVID-19 state of emergency until the end of January, allowing it to enact measures fast, bypassing the usual red tape.
NPR's Silvia Pagioli. Singer-songwriter Johnny Nash has died at his home in Houston at the age of 80. His son saying he died of natural causes. NPR's Trina Williams has this appreciation.
Johnny Nash is best known for his 1972 hit, I Can See Clearly Now.
I can see clearly now.
The song has been covered multiple times by artists including Ray Charles and Donny Osmond. Jimmy Cliff's version was featured on the 1993 Cool Runnings movie soundtrack. Nash was born in Houston. He had early success in the 50s with pop tunes and as an actor, also co-owning a record company. The crooner moved to Jamaica in the 60s, becoming one of a few U.S.-born singers of reggae music. He also became friends with a young Bob Marley, helping to launch his career, along with fellow Wailers Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer. Nash was less visible by the 90s, releasing his last studio album in 1986. Trina Williams, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Total Wine and More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com.
Listener support allows KRVS to provide exceptional programs in unprecedented times. You can help make sure that we can continue to grow to meet the ever-changing needs of our community. Contribute to your local source for news and information, music and culture at krvs.org.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Whether you're doing scholarly research or just want to indulge in an afternoon of history, there's nowhere better for that than the historic New Orleans collection. When forced to close their galleries earlier this year due to the pandemic, they jumped into action, making extensive changes and additions to their online offerings to help us all stay entertained and informed, even while quarantined. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we talk with Daniel Hammer, the collection's president and CEO, to learn more about what's new online. We'll take a virtual tour of their new galleries and revisit Purchased Lives, a powerful exhibit from 2015 that's an in-depth examination of New Orleans' role in the slave trade, which now exists entirely online. We're serving a delicious taste of Louisiana history, care of the historic New Orleans collection, on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Daniel Hammer, president and CEO of the historic New Orleans collection.
Since the coronavirus shutdown in March, organizations of all stripes have been working on ways to operate safely while continuing operations. The historic New Orleans collection is no different. The nonprofit has been adapting to new measures to preserve history for visitors virtually or in person. Back in June, while New Orleans was still in phase one of the COVID-19, we spoke with Daniel Hammer to see how the historic New Orleans collection was faring in this brave new world. Daniel, when you became president and CEO almost a year ago, did you ever think you'd face something like this pandemic situation?
It did not occur to me, Poppy, that this might happen. I don't know what to say, you know? I refuse to say that I'm surprised by anything.
Before this happened, what was the reaction like at 520 Royal to the expansion? I mean, you all were really getting some fabulous attention.
Absolutely. We opened the new facility at 520 Royal Street in the spring of 2019. And we had immediately upon opening just a great number of visitors and really high level of interest. I feel that we continue to still have that at this time. We've continued to be open online. We've really expanded what we do online in order to make our website the front door of our museum, essentially. We created a portion of our website called History From Home, and we serve up all of our online content there now. And it's kind of become like the 520 Royal Street of the internet for us. It's a very clear to understand that it's a museum site where you can engage with all sorts of different content for adults and for kids, you know, to enjoy from home, enriching materials from our collection, engaging exercises that people can do, like a oral history program and curricula to learn how to play chess using Paul Morphy as your guide, and all sorts of cool stuff. You know, I feel that we've adjusted as well as we could, given the very difficult circumstances. We've gotten an opportunity to do a lot more online than we would have been doing if it hadn't have been forced upon us. And so I guess I just choose to see the positive in that.
I'm curious, from your point of view, in a time when we're dealing with a pandemic, how is history important?
You know, it's important for a lot of reasons. I've been really struck by the way to which people in general have been drawn to historical subjects during this time. It seems that around the country, we've seen people have just a very significant interest in engaging with history and the study of culture online while they're at home. Why that is hard to say. Certainly, I think that in times of crisis, it's typical for people to look to the past to learn how to deal with the current situation. There are lots of examples in the history of New Orleans of times where a great deal of resilience was required of the people of this city. Certainly, our collections tell lots of stories like that. The first ones that come to mind for me are from our recent history. So most notably, we've done this after Hurricane Katrina. We did major oral history work in the aftermath of Katrina to document the experiences of a wide range of first responders. Furthermore, we've used oral history in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And once again, we're turning to oral history now as a major way to document the experience of people in our community during the pandemic.
Daniel, tell me a little bit more about From the Frontline, narratives of the COVID-19 pandemic in New Orleans.
You know, well, what does the front line mean? Yes, is what the question is. You know, in some ways, the front line is like the first responders. It's these critical people in our community who go out into harm's way to confront a disaster or a crisis. But with the pandemic, truly the front line is much broader than that, because it also encompasses the people who are on the front lines of suffering from the disease that is everybody in our community. Of course, as we've learned, sometimes in shocking fashion, there's been a disproportionate impact of the disease on people of color, on people with underlying health conditions, with people who have underlying health conditions due to systemic social issues. And so the front line in the case of the pandemic also includes sectors within our larger New Orleans community, where we can reach out and engage with people about experiences within their circles of the pandemic. And so we're working to build a community advisory board to this project now. We have a lot of great folks already signed on to that, and we're still looking to expand the project further. It's a nascent project. We've done some initial interviews already, but we see ourselves doing it over many years, and hope to, in the future, also be able to do lots of great programming, including exhibitions that look at resiliency in New Orleans across the broadest possible definition of the New Orleans community.
Now that things began to open up again a little bit, you came up with some things that are new, and some other things you already had in place have become even more important.
Right. Well, you know, as we gain clearance to reopen, we wanted to do so as soon as possible. But of course, we also are very dedicated to being a place that's safe for our staff and for our visitors. And so we have wonderful outdoor spaces in our French Quarter facilities, our courtyards. And moreover, the French Quarter itself is in many ways an outdoor space. The streets of the French Quarter, that street grid, is New Orleans' oldest historic artifact, first laid out in 1722. There are no buildings that date back that far, just the streets. So we set about creating some self-guided experiences, focusing on our courtyards, adding some interpretive materials, panels with information to the courtyard so that people could read about the history of the buildings. We also have a resource, which is an app called French Quarter Tours, which has 8 guided walking tours of the French Quarter that you can download to your own phone, and you can take 8 different tours all around the French Quarter on different subjects, from literature and music to the history of the slave trade in the French Quarter and free people of color in the French Quarter, all different subjects. You know, we really are an anchor in the French Quarter that serves to provide people with a connection to the history, which is such an important part of the French Quarter for all of us. There's an opportunity in the historic fabric of the French Quarter to tell the stories of anybody who is connected to New Orleans, no matter what their background is, no matter what their lived experience is or the experience of their ancestors is. It has that potential for everybody. And so I think that is the role that we play, is to make that possible for people to connect with that meaning and make the French Quarter for all of us, no matter who we are, predominantly important due to its historic value.
That was Daniel Hammer, president and CEO of the Historic New Orleans Collection. On September 8th, the collection was able to reopen their tricentennial wing on Royal Street, where today you can visit 3 new exhibits. And of course, you can visit virtually online anytime. Coming up next, we continue our conversation with Daniel as we discuss the HNOC's touring exhibit, Purchased Lives. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
We're always checking out new music during our time together on the radio. This week, we'll delve further into recent releases and debuts on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
When she was 18, way before running for office, Stacey Abrams was invited to the governor's mansion in Georgia. She was stopped at the gate.
The guard looks at me, looks at my parents, he looks at the bus that's pulling away, and he tells us we don't belong here.
The lessons we learn outside the classroom from the school of life. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 8, right here on KRVS.
This is listener-supported public radio for Acadiana, KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Like us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from Ralph's on the Park, located on City Park Avenue in Mid-City. Now open for dinner with dine-in and balcony dining Wednesday through Sunday, with lunch on Fridays and brunch served on weekends. Family-style dinner service for curbside pickup continues Wednesday through Sunday. To learn more, visit ralphsonthepark.com or reach them directly at 504-488-1000. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. you're just joining us, we're speaking with Historic New Orleans Collection President and CEO Daniel Hammer. Back in 2015, the HNOC presented one of the most impactful museum exhibitions I've ever seen, entitled Purchased Lives.
Purchased Lives was an exhibition that we did at the collection in 2015, and it is about the domestic slave trade in the United States from 1808 until 1865. For me, there were two things about it that really made it so impactful. One was the presence of this place that we know and hold dear in the exhibition itself. To be in the French Quarter, in our museum, and to be reading these stories of people who were bought and sold in the same place was a very powerful thing. And then to leave the museum and go out into the street and be standing before these sites of sale and these sites of imprisonment, to still be in that place, just made it all the more powerful. And so the exhibition was very much an exhibition that needed to take place in New Orleans, where it was. The other thing about it that just was very powerful was the extent to which it was successful in explaining the ubiquity of the slave trade in the commerce of the nation and the psyche, the national psyche of the people. It was, I think, one of the most important examples of an exploration of the history of slavery in the United States that really made it clear to anybody who saw the exhibition that slavery was a national industry, a national phenomenon, that it wasn't a Southern thing purely, but that it was the underpinning of the entire nation in many ways. After being on display here, it in fact traveled to sites around the country. We got a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to travel the exhibition to three other museums: the Alexandria Museum of Art in Alexandria, Louisiana, the Bullock State, Texas History Museum in Austin, Texas, and the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. We also subsequently traveled the exhibition to Skokie, Illinois, outside of Chicago, to the Illinois Holocaust Museum, which requested the exhibition. And so in each of those locations where the museum, where the exhibition traveled to, in order to have that aspect of place be present in the exhibition, new components of the exhibit were curated that were specific to those locations, mm-hmm. in order to give anybody who viewed the exhibit that same sort of a sense of immediate connection to the story that was being told, the story of people being bought and sold. I think the exhibition helps to underscore, through examples like that, the depravity that is at the root of slavery, American slavery, and helps us to understand that there are no excuses for not seeing that depravity.
That was Daniel Hammer, President and CEO of the Historic New Orleans Collection. The story of slavery in the U.S. usually centers on Africans kidnapped from their villages and forced onto sailing ships destined for America. As horrific as the transatlantic slave trade was, what enslaved people endured during the domestic slave trade that thrived between 1808 and 1865 was frankly much worse. Former Historic New Orleans Collection curator Aaron Greenwald spent 2 years researching this harrowing chapter in our nation's history. The resulting 2015 exhibit, Purchased Lives, deeply impacted visitors, with 15,000 people ultimately visiting the display when it was here in New Orleans. Back in 2015, Aaron graciously agreed to give us a personal tour of purchased lives. Here are some of the most poignant moments of our tour and conversation.
Well, the exhibition is called Purchased Lives, New Orleans and the Domestic Slave Trade, and it covers the period from 1808 to 1865. The exhibition focuses specifically on the domestic trade. That means the movement of peoples within the confines of the United States, not the transatlantic trade, which you probably know more about. Between 1808 and 1865, more than a million people were forcibly moved from the Upper South, places like Virginia, Maryland, D.C., North Carolina, to the Lower South.
What caused that to happen?
Well, I think the most immediate change is the 1808 United States prohibition on the international slave trade. So when the Constitution was written and ratified, there was a 20-year clause built in that stated that the international slave trade would end in 1808. And that begins the process of the forced migration of more than a million people from the Upper South to the Lower South in the 19th century.
How were these people actually moved?
Well, believe it or not, the vast majority of individuals came on foot, hundreds and hundreds of miles, typically in what was known as a coffle. So two by two, men chained together, force marched with women and children behind over all sorts of terrain. And because of where we are in New Orleans, people often arrive via a combination of on foot and boat.
One of the things that it's hard for me to comprehend, a trip hundreds and hundreds of miles chained to another human. How did they manage to live through that?
Let's walk into this exhibition gallery and we'll talk about that specifically.
As we walked further into the exhibit, I noticed what seemed to be a wanted poster for an escaped slave.
So in the 19th century, humans were actually some of the most valuable commodities in the United States. The equivalent now of purchasing what was known as a prime male laborer, say a strong, healthy man between the ages of 18 and 25, the equivalent now is about $47,000 for one individual laborer. When people arrived, typically the first thing that happened is traders who were eager to get their human wares back up to speed and in good health would take them to a local infirmary. And in the exhibition, we talk about how people were prepared for market like cattle. Touro Infirmary, miraculously, wonderfully, has held on to their very first patient register. Touro opened in 1855, and we have on display the patient register from 1855 to 1860. And this register shows us that before the Civil War, 45% of all of Touro's patients were enslaved.
That's amazing.
It is unbelievable. And because of the kinds of information that's recorded in this register, we also know that of that 45%, a significant number were being brought to Touro by slave traders for the sole purposes of getting them healthy.
So tell me a little bit about what was it like to be a slave when it came to the table?
Well, I think it really in large part depends on where an individual was enslaved. Here in the city of New Orleans, someone may have had a different experience than someone living in Alexandria or Marksville, for example. But typically, enslaved laborers received a ration every week. They would receive a cup of cornmeal a day, maybe 2-3 pounds of lesser cuts of pork, and that would be expected to sustain them. But of course, that wasn't enough to sustain a human being for a week or a month or a lifetime. And so frequently, especially here in Louisiana, individuals would supplement their diets through rice. Rice was often substituted for cornmeal here and also along the Georgia and South Carolina coast where rice was also grown. You had a lot of individuals growing their own gardens, keeping their own gardens. Some people had to work those gardens at night because they didn't have the opportunity to do that during the day because their labor was in use by someone else, by their owners. And so people would grow yams and root vegetables. One of the interesting things to remember in visiting this exhibition is that approximately 450,000 people arrived here from Africa in what is now the present-day United States prior to 1808. Between 1808 and 1865, more than a million people, so twice as many people as were brought in the African slave trade, more than a million people were moved from the Upper South to the Lower South. And this had a great impact on our food habits, our eating habits, because you have people coming from places like Maryland and Virginia with different food experiences from the French-speaking Catholic Creole population here in Lower Louisiana.
So there becomes a melting pot even in the food pots.
That's absolutely right. Food and language and everything else that you might be able to imagine, all of our cultural legacies are shaped by this cross-pollination that's happening throughout the 19th century.
Next, we went upstairs where there was a wall of old newspaper postings.
So after the Civil War ended in 1865, one of the very first things that thousands and thousands of people who were enslaved, particularly in the Deep South, but across the country, these people who'd been freed, one of the very first things that they did was try to find family members that had been separated from them during slavery. And they did that in a variety of ways. But the most common was to place an ad in a newspaper. Here in New Orleans, we had two newspapers that ran what were called either information wanted or lost friends advertisements. One was the Black Republican, which was published here beginning in 1865, and the other was the Southwestern Christian Advocate. And people would write things like, "Dear editor, I wish to inquire for my folks. Emmeline Scott was my mother, but she is dead. Brothers Perry, Jacob, and Mowallen Scott, sisters Martha and Jane Louisa Scott, they all belonged to Miss S.C. Morgan, who lived in the eastern part of Maryland, except mother. Address me at New Orleans, Louisiana, Perrier, near Penniston Streets." And this was submitted to the Southwestern Christian Advocate by a woman named Melvany Yorker. And there are thousands and thousands of these classified ads that were placed in New Orleans newspapers, even when there didn't seem to be a connection to New Orleans, mm-hmm. because people knew that New Orleans was the largest slave market in the South, they took a chance and placed ads here, hoping that they would find out about their relatives. Now, the war ended in 1865, and these advertisements continued to be placed into the first decade of the 20th century. So trying to find people was really, really complicated. The Black Church played a huge role in trying to unite people, because you have to remember a lot of these individuals were illiterate. They had been forbidden from learning how to read and write during slavery. And so the Black churches often read these classifieds from the pulpit all across the South, and this is how people attempted to put their families back together.
Moments from our 2015 tour of Purchased Lives with former Historic New Orleans Collection curator Aaron Greenwald. While the exhibit is not currently on display, you can experience it virtually at hnoc.org. Since it was founded in 1966, the Historic New Orleans Collection has grown to include several historic buildings, making up two French Quarter campuses. In spring 2019, the HNOC expanded further when they opened a new exhibition center at 520 Royal Street. It's the first to house the city's only continuing exhibit on the Quarter's history. A history as old as the structure itself.
I'm John Lawrence, Director of Museum Programs at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and we're here at the Signor Ray Brulator House, the newest project of our institution. This complex encompasses over two centuries of architecture.
Originally built in 1816, The Seigneurie Brûlatour House has served many functions over its lifetime. When Louisiana Eats visited in 2019, John Lawrence joined us in the courtyard and then invited us upstairs, where he described for us the fascinating history of the house and its owners.
François Seigneurie is the builder of the house that survives today, this 1816, so just over 200-year-old structure. François Seigneurie operated two principal enterprises on this. One was a furniture making workshop, and we have examples of Seigneurie's furniture that he either built or had imported to sell as a retailer. But he was also an importer of Bordeaux wine. Pierre Brûlatour, a later tenant or owner in the 19th century, also was a wine merchant, as was Pierre Cavarac, who had a brief tenancy here as a wine importer. And in the early 20th century, we see William Irby enter the picture. Irby's fortune was made in the tobacco business. His philanthropy, as well as his ownership of the building, gives us a very, very strong identity for this address during the decades between the World Wars, when William Irby granted use of portions of the building to the Arts and Crafts Club of New Orleans. I think it's at this point, with all of the art students and art lovers on premises, we begin to see the Brûlatour Courtyard, as it was known, become one of the almost shorthand references for all courtyards in New Orleans. And then in the early 1950s, WDSU occupies this as their television studio, the first in New Orleans. And I think for many New Orleanians, this will be the touchstone that they have. And again, that courtyard became a signature identity with the TV station. They would do broadcasts from the courtyard. They would feature it on their station promos.
The third floor exhibit in the building is made up of eight thematic galleries, each presenting different aspects of French Quarter history, the first of its kind in the Crescent City. As John took us into the first gallery, we could hear the sounds of the new immersive film installation next door.
Yes, a 300-year sweep of the French Quarter at nighttime. Certainly, today's visitors associate certain thing with the French Quarter at night, whether it's having a drink or listening to music or going out to eat. But we wanted to kind of break out of that narrow view of what happens to the French in the French Quarter at night.
As we walked through each gallery, we viewed artifacts that painted a portrait of the Vieux Carré, framed by topics like transportation, media, and commerce. John was quick to show us how the city's culinary history has always been part of our narrative.
If you look at this tourist map of 1942, you can see that Broussards and Galatoires and Antoines are all picked out as highlights on this map, along with historical markers like the Pontalba buildings and the Jackson statue and any number of other places that we associate with the French Quarter. Also in here, we talk about residents of the French Quarter. We begin with the Native Americans. We talk about German presence in the French Quarter. We have materials that relate to the Sicilian population of New Orleans and also the Chinese population in New Orleans. I think all of this, whether we're talking about food or just other elements of daily life, it's clear that today still, but perhaps less so, the French Quarter was a neighborhood, and it was a place where people lived, where they worked. You could find everything you needed within the confines of the district, and maybe that's not as true today, but it's something that we wanted people to understand in this exhibition, that it wasn't just a place for visitors. It was a place where residents lived their lives and had very full, rich, creative lives as well.
John Lawrence, Director of Museum Programs at the Historic New Orleans Collection. Our visit barely scratched the surface of the offerings on display in the three-story complex. The only way to truly appreciate it is to visit yourself. While experiences like the French Quarter galleries are closed due to COVID-19, the complex has recently reopened and offers several other installations to view. Admission is free, but tickets must be ordered in advance of arrival. And that immersive film experience? While you can't see it for yourself right now, don't worry. We've got a taste of the experience to hold you over till it opens up again. We speak with legendary Louisiana filmmaker Glenn Petrie next. But first, how did the historic New Orleans collection come to exist right there in the heart of the French Quarter? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Are you interested in K-pop music, but can never find it on your local radio? Well, look no further. With K-pop Fever, we have boy groups, girl groups, soloists, and all of your K-pop favorites. So join me, JC, on Mondays at midnight with KRVS on 88.7 FM radio.
Cajun, swamp pop, zydeco, creole, and more. It's all right here on Encore. With me, your host, Megan Constantin. Saturday mornings at 7 and Sunday afternoons at 3.
Later today on This American Life, a doctor sleeps with 11 of his patients, goes before a medical disciplinary board. He is still practicing medicine today. A doctor gives his prescription pad to somebody, who then prescribes controlled substances for cash. The doctor goes before a disciplinary board. They do not take his license. He is still practicing medicine today. Why this happens, later today.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Louisiana Fish Fry, breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Just 40 minutes from New Orleans, Louisiana North Shore's Tammany Taste features the bounty of the bayou and rich culinary culture from award-winning chefs, mom-and-pop restaurants, specialty bakers, and creative mixologists. To discover more, request the newly released Explore the North Shore Inspiration Guide for local stories, custom itineraries, and event information at LouisianaNorthShore.com. St. Tammany Parish, where New Orleans has come to play and get away for more than a century. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. How did the historic New Orleans collection come to exist, right there in the heart of the French Quarter? You could say, essentially, it all started in 1938 when General L. Kemper and his wife, Leela Williams, bought two properties in the French Quarter. The Marriott House in the 500 block of Royal Street, along with a late 19th century residence contiguous to the Marriott House facing Toulouse. The latter property served as their home for 17 years, during which time they amassed a substantial collection of important Louisiana artifacts, which formed the original basis of the historic New Orleans collection. to ensure future generations would have access to their collections. Upon their deaths, the Kemper and Lila Williams Foundation was established, creating long-term financial support for the collection. With the incredible success and expansion of the HNOC, what would the Kempers have to say today? It's my guess they'd be very pleased with how their legacy lives on in the city they loved. You can take a virtual tour of the Williams residence and learn more about their lives by listening to a past episode of Louisiana Eats. You'll find the link on our homepage at poppytooker.com. And now, back to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Glenn Petrie. My wife, Michelle Benoit, and I were the writers, producers, and directors of The French Quarter by Night, which is the immersive film at the new facility at 520 Royal Street.
As part of the historic New Orleans collection's 520 Royal Street expansion, Louisiana filmmaker Glenn Petrie and his wife, Michelle Benoit, created an immersive film that fills a room with imagery and sound. Projected on four walls and played in a continuous loop, the 17-minute experience showcases over three centuries of the French Quarter after nightfall.
Andiamo!
Throw the ball!
Andiamo! Get your papa for supper!
Okay, Mama.
With the exhibition space currently closed, we wanted to share a slice of that experience with you. Here's our 2019 conversation with Glenn Petrie at the HNOC discussing the project. This experience is like no other. You sit in this darkened space, and 300 years of New Orleans history happens around you in 17 minutes. How did you make that magic happen?
It was a long road. It was a long project, 2 years, 9 months from the day they called us in and said, would you do this till it opened to the public? And it presented so many challenges, both technical, because it's, you know, I've been making movies, you know, my whole adult life, and I'm used to that horizontal rectangle on the screen, and that's where you tell your story. And here was one where the mandate was, it's got to be all around you. It's got to surround you. So there's multiple projectors, there's 10 channels of sound, and just figuring out how to tell a story that way. Because, you know, people don't have eyes in the back of their head, so how do you get them to turn around and see the next thing starting up over here and the next thing starting up over here? It's also, unlike a regular movie, where it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That's the first thing you learn about, you know, screenwriting. This one, you don't know when people are going to walk in. They walk in whenever, and they leave the moment they get bored. So the mandate is grab them quick, and don't let them get bored.
gentlemen, step right up, step right in. Come see the burlesque show.
So there was the technical things, and then just trying to squeeze in so many different aspects, and the, you know, the script get longer and longer because we got to have this, we got to have a section about restaurants, and we got to have something on Bourbon Street, and we got to have the colonial times. Well, there's French colonial and Spanish colonial, and then the Americans got it, and there's a battle in New Orleans, and then, you know, and wait a minute, what was it like before, you know, the white man got here and the riverbank?
You get the sense in the start of the film that you are there before the white men arrive. Explain how you made that magic.
There were a lot of technical tricks. We started with the photographs of Frank Relly, who actually has a gallery on Royal Street, who does a lot of nighttime treescapes, because we needed oak trees, which is would have been a thing, but then cypress along the riverbank. And then we had Charlie Lavoy, who was our, you know, ace animator, visual effects supervisor, started compositing and putting that together into pieces so that we you know, had these various pictures because they had to go all around you. And then we brought into our studio branches and palmetto leaves and moss so we could add to it. And foolish me, going to do it in front of a green screen if people know what green screen looks like, and got it all set up and realized, well, the leaves are green too. They're going to disappear as well. So we had to build a blue screen, by which point all the leaves had shriveled up. So I had to get new branches and do it all over again. And then when the Choctaw Indians arrived, we first spot the New Orleans a building, we got to Pomi Indians and filmed that through the screen arts program at LSU. So we're actually in the quad under one of those oak trees, and we blacked out the library in the background and had lights at night, and had them dressed. And one of the Native Americans is actually an attorney, and he was a little shy about getting into a loincloth, on the LSU quad. But we talked him into it. We gave him a fake fur cape. So that built picture, but then you have to build sound.
One of the dazzling facts to me were all of the different voices and dialects going on through. There's no subtitles. It's like you're eavesdropping on 300 years of conversations.
Well, first of all, you don't subtitle a gumbo. You don't subtitle a fricassee. You let the flavors blend. I know there's Choctaw, there's Igbo, there's Wolof, there's French, there's Spanish, there's English, there's Latin, there's Italian, there's Sicilian, which is a separate language, and then Castilian Spanish, and we also have Spanish with a Canary Island accent mixed in. So trying to get those things in there. And again, it's just for flavor. The hope is people go in and let it wash over them because there are no subtitles, there's no explanations. There's some things that most people, won't get.
Have you seen my papa?
Try the saloon.
Try the saloon.
Who killed the chief?
Who killed the chief?
There was an anti-Italian catcall, very common in the early 1900s, called Who Killed a Chief? Who Killed a Chief? Because there was a police chief who had been murdered, and it was assumed that the Sicilians had done it. So we wanted to get that in there. So we found some, there's a scene with some kids, so we had the kids do that. There was, wanted to get a Bourbon Street barker in there, so we got somebody to riff. But the trick was, this thing is going on, you're traveling through all these different eras and all these different subjects and all these different things, and you didn't want to hear the same few voices over and over. So we have, a few hundred different people whose voices appear in this thing. And it got to be a joke that nobody could stop by our studio over on Mandeville Street without being nabbed and put in front of a microphone and say, could you tell them not to bruise the bananas as they unload the boat? Or could you tell them, order up with another order coming in? And just all the different things.
Order in! 3 chicken clementines.
Amazingly, in that 17 minutes, you've got a lot of food in there. Would you walk us through your food moments?
There are a couple that really jumped for me. One was modern day, and we filmed the kitchen at Arno's, and it served two purposes. One is just the restaurant tradition, but also we wanted to show that, Bourbon Street is not just a place where tourists visit. It's a place where locals work. And so we went behind the scenes at the kitchen, and for most of the film, because people are up close to the screen, it's all around you, and you're not sitting way back like you're in a movie theater, so you can't have things too big because you can't see them. But for that, we wanted it big. So, when the flames shoot up from the frying pan, it's 5 feet high, and it's all around you. And the sounds of a kitchen, order up, and people are calling, this and that. I mean, a lot of folks, when they enjoy their meals, don't appreciate the hustle that went into putting that on the table, everything at once, everything served hot, just, looking so beautiful on the plate. So that's one. The other, for me, that really says food is when we recreated the French market circa 1900. there's a woman who's, she's 102 now. I guess she was 100, straight up 100 when I interviewed her. Memory-like attack, and talked about the French market, and they would go, and they'd go at night. You know, they'd go Thursday night was the time to see and be seen, because Friday you'd eat fish. It's, you know, it's a very Catholic town. Friday you'd eat fish. So you'd go on Thursday night to buy what you'd need, but because everybody was going, it's you'd wear your nicest clothes and stuff. So, you know, there are touches here and there, you know, relating to food, because food was just so much, you know, part of this community, this history, the French Quarter, the French, you know. At one point early on, we thought about, well, maybe we use one of those scenting systems so you can, you know, smell the cooking and stuff. And it was just technically way too complicated. There was no way to confine it to just that room. But there are certainly hints of the food. Yeah, we see food at work. Yeah.
That was Glenn Petrie, co-creator of the French Quarter by Night. The experience is temporarily closed due to COVID-19. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where we have 10 years of Louisiana Eats editions available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and videos, too. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. And from D'Agostino Pasta, handcrafted in Louisiana from semolina wheat and air-dried over rods in wooden cellars, D'Agostino Pasta is made just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. D'Agostino's all-natural, preservative-free pasta is available in traditional forms, as well as their signature alligator, crawfish, and fleur-de-lis-shaped pastas. Visit D'AgostinoPasta.com to learn more. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by The Commissary, Dickie Brennan's latest venture offering complete family-style meals featuring signature dishes from Dickie's other restaurants and DIY kits for home cooking. Takeout is available Thursday through Sunday at 634 Orange Street in the Lower Garden District. You can reach them at 504-274-1850 or visit online, thecommissarynola.com. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and producer and special projects manager Reggie Morris, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.
Harpistry, an eclectic mix of harp-centric world music, Mondays at noon and Sundays at midnight, right here on KRVS.